Another common theme we noticed is how 1930s English teachers emphasized the unique challenges and opportunities of writing for radio. For the most part, they didn't just have students write a research paper and then read it out loud.
Yeah, students were writing in genres specific to radio. The audio drama, the news broadcast, the commercial.
And they showed awareness of how writing for the time-based medium of radio is different than writing for print. In a 1939 article, Mildred Carson explains,
"We stress the fact that radio writing is different from other kinds of creative writing, and that condensation rather than amplification by words is necessary."
Yeah, as we've been working on this project, we keep on revising for concision. Carson was onto something there.
That she was. And in a 1933 article, Jay Newland calls attention to the challenges of conveying a narrative solely through audio media.
"Radio audiences are of necessity ear-minded. That is, they do not have the advantage of gesture, facial and body expression, and movements about the stage. It is of primary importance, then, to see that there are no unnecessarily long sentences in the manuscript, and that there is no need for any expression other than the vocal to make the points clear."
Yeah, I think Newland usefully points to how teaching audio writing necessarily entails critical reflections about the limitations and the affordances of audio media for storytelling.
But then again, Newland could be a little problematic. It wasn't just Ruth Batten who wrote some unfortunate things back then.
Oh, right. How could we forget? Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Jay Newland.
"Having written the manuscript and carefully timed it, the next step is the selection of the speaker or speakers. In general, and this is doubly true of younger girls and women should be avoided. More than half of the women and girls have voices which are simply too high-pitched for the average radio microphone, and the result is an impression of affectation which wholly ruins the effect of an otherwise good speech. It is, of course, unnecessary to remark that no one who has the slightest impediment of speech has any business on a radio team. For the microphone seems to take a grim delight in distorting the slightest defect."
This is such ridiculous horse.
You're right, Jason. It is ridiculous horse. But you need to take a moment and calm down.
Okay. Newland is sexist and ableist and redonkulous, but I have to admit he was writing a long time ago. But what really enrages me is that these attitudes have not gone away.
This attitude extends into popular media as well. Pundits say sexist crap about Hillary Clinton's voice all the time.
And Donald Trump mocked the speaking style of a reporter with a disability just because that reporter had called him out on his bullshit.
And let's not forget the media's obsessive reporting on the so-called growing trend of vocal fry among adolescent girls.
Too true. I'm reminded of that CNC article by Ads and Anthem, Garrett and Matsky, where they tell the cautionary tale of a woman student who chose to recruit a man to read her voiceover because she thought a masculine voice would be more authoritative.
And didn't that Comstock and Hawks article in CNC Online also address that same issue?
It sure did. So, as we teach audio writing, this reminds us that we need to be very careful to call attention to and actively resist the sexist, ableist, classist, and racist assumptions about language and voice that continue to influence how we engage audio media.
Preach.